One. Hey guys, today I've got the Don of Wall Street, or at least one of the Dons of Wall Street, speaking to the Emperor of Academia, Anthony Scaramucci. Before I say hello, let me tell you a bit about him in case you haven't heard of him. He's a co-managing partner and founder of Skybridge Capital, $12 billion in assets under management and advisement as of early October of this year. Co-host of Wall Street Week on Fox Business, ranked 91st in worth.
85, brother.
Oh, you're up now. All
Oh,
right.
yeah, they moved me in 2016.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah,
In
just
worth.
imagine those poor SOBs that are behind me thinking, what the hell is he doing ahead of me? I don't know. Keep going.
I like it. In Worth Magazine's Power 100, and served on the national campaign finance committees of Mitt Romney and Donald Trump. And of course, if you support Donald Trump, then you must be a Nazi. You must be a member of
Racist.
racist, Islamophobe, Jewphobe, and so on.
Misogynist. I don't know.
Misogynist.
You know,
So we'll
I don't
talk.
get. So you'll have to explain that to me, Doc. How they've hijacked the moral mountain. And so if you're for Secretary Clinton, and I don't need to list all of the allegations that are made about her, but if you're for her, there's no moral shame in that. But if you're for Donald Trump, well, then you're to be rocked and stoned. Yeah,
You're a
someone has
Nazi. We're going to talk about
to.
that. Don't
I'll
worry, we're
talk
coming
about
back.
that in a sec. Yeah.
Three books.
He's got three Orthodox Jewish grandchildren, by the way, but we'll talk about it. Go ahead,
We'll
keep
talk
going.
about that. So, Goodbye, Gordon Gekko, How to Find Your Fortune Without Losing Your Soul, 2010. The Little Book of Hedge Funds, and 2012. And the one that is just about to be released, Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, How Entrepreneurs Turn Failure into Success. So I thought we'd start with your latest book and take it from there, and then we'll hit Trump eventually. Tell us about
Okay.
your book.
Well, you know, I really try to in the first two books, I really try to write in what I call an unsanitized version of things. And so in Goodbye, Gordon Gekko, I talked about wearing polyester at my first job interview. I talked about getting fired from Goldman Sachs, failing the bar exam twice, even though I went to Harvard Law School. And I really tried to write a rite of passage book. In The Little Book of Hedge Funds, I said, okay, here's everything that stinks about the hedge fund industry, and then tried to write a balance book. And hopping over the rabbit hole, we basically were on a super descent in 2008 and 9. And if you were doing this interview with me in 2009, I said, geez, Doc, I think we're going to be out of business. We were crippled by the financial crisis. And so we took a number of progressive, active, aggressive steps to turn the business around. And so I thought it would be an interesting book to catalog what those steps were, to talk about the self-consciousness, the fear, the insecurity. How about the loss of status? You know, that you couldn't go to a cocktail party and tell anybody that you were successful while your fund was going from 400 million to 200 million. And so I tried to write about that in a very honest and very open way, so that if an entrepreneur grabbed the book and they looked through it, they say, okay, this is how it really happens. This isn't the, you know, I hate these books where someone turns out successful and then they write this sanitized version of themselves where they were doing everything perfectly, didn't make any mistakes, and they're on this 45-degree slope to the promised land. Listen, you know, Tony Robbins, who's been on my show, he's a terrific guy. I sent him the manuscript and he said, listen, I'll write the intro for you. And then, of course, I don't know if you know the futurist Peter Diamandis, but he's a best-selling author as well. So I'm getting a little help from my buddies in
Nice.
selling the book.
Incidentally,
That was the goal of the book.
I'll ask you some questions about the book. But since you mentioned Anthony Robbins, I just watched while exercising on my elliptical his Netflix documentary. It
Yeah.
was very interesting. I didn't know much about him, and he certainly is a very passionate guy. But
Passionate. I mean, he was unleashing a little bit of profanity in that documentary. People are criticizing him for that, but he wanted it to be real and unfiltered, and a full expression of himself. So I give him a lot of credit for that documentary. I recommend that to your listeners and your chat room people. You gotta watch that if you get a chance.
Right on. So let's get back to your book. So I guess one of the first things that one has to take away from your book is to at least have the humility to accept the fact that we make mistakes, right? And
No question.
I've personally interacted with entrepreneurs, some of whom are family members, who I think did not have the room, the humility room, in their heart, in their personhood, to say, look, I made a mistake. Hey, I'm not so knowledgeable about everything that I shouldn't be listening to other people's input. So is this something that you find as one of the key impediments to taking some of the stuff that you're saying away from your book, because people are too egotistical to accept that they make mistakes?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think it's rough. I mean, and if you look in the political world, the political consultants tell these politicians to never admit any mistakes. And the reason they do that is that a political consultant would tell the politician, don't admit the mistake, because that'll be the news cycle for the next 3 months from your opponents. Oh, look, he made a mistake and he admitted it, you know, or she made a mistake. So I think it's nonsense to be candid. I think that as an entrepreneur, if you want to save your career and you want to save your business, you have to not only admit mistakes, but you have to surround your surround yourself with people that can come to you and it tell you the mistakes that you're making. And so I often say to people that at SkyBridge, we have a slap up and kiss down culture. So I come from a family of service people. Neither one of my parents went to college. My grandmother, frankly, came here from Italy and started out as a maid, then worked in a laundromat. So I tell the people at SkyBridge, if you don't treat the people underneath you well, then I'm going to have no use for you here at SkyBridge. That person that's subordinate to you could be my grandmother or could have been my grandmother. And so you got to treat these people well. Flip side, you need to come into my office and tell me what I'm doing wrong so that I can improve the company. You know, I worked at Lehman Brothers, which I do reference in the book. A lot of that was not going on there. There was a circle of sycophants telling the emperor that he had great clothing on when he was standing there stark naked, overexposed with too much risk. And if you allow yourself to get absorbed in that sort of cylinder or that cyclical process, it could be a nightmare for your business.
Speaking of respecting service people, that's a really great point, because I think for those of you out there listening to this chat, if you go out on a date, one of the best things to take away from the prospective suitor that you're with is how they, I think, respond to the waiter or waitress, right? I
mean, no question.
That reminds me of, I don't know if you saw the movie Bronx Tale, where...
Yeah, sure.
Right?
With the car.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah, of course.
That is such a fantastic step. Let me mention it for those folks who might not know it. So at one point, the main character, the main protagonist, is about to go out on a date with this woman, a girl from his high school, and this sort of mob boss tells him, make sure to check when you open the door for her, if then when you're turning back to get to the driver's seat, if she moves over and opens the door for you, that
unlocks it. Yeah, exactly. He wanted to unlock the hinge on the door.
And that's a little snippet of whether you are self-absorbed or not. So I love those types of, very actionable advice.
Yeah, well, the waiter rule is a great, great thing to tell people. Watch out, because here's what happens with the waiter. Most people view the waiter interaction is a one-off transaction with another human being. They don't view it as a permanent relationship. And so it really tells you whether a person has niceness in their personality, if they're considerate and compassionate. I tell a really fun story in this book about a gentleman by the name of Joaquin. He was my waiter at the Harvard Club when I left Goldman Sachs. And just to be brief, but he's waiting on me and I tip these guys very generously. And then about 3 years into him taking care of me, he comes over to me and he says, "Hey, Mr. Anthony, you know, you're in money management, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, listen," he says, "you know, unfortunately, there was an accident in my family and my son, who was injured on the job, just received a $35 million workers' compensation claim. And could you manage this money for me?" And so there you go. Here's the waiter who you would say, okay, probably wouldn't have that level of money or have that level of access. But because I treated him with the respect and kindness, he offered that money over to me to have me manage it for him. Now, truth be told, I didn't end up managing it for him because I wasn't the right person. But I did refer him to somebody that was, and they have a terrific relationship to this day. But my point is that you would have lost that opportunity if you weren't just a nice person.
Well, I mean, at one point at the start of your story, you said about repeat interactions. That's actually a term that's very relevant in the work that I do as an academic, right? In evolutionary theory, we talk about reciprocity, and it's a theme that comes up a few times in your book. I mean, relationship marketing is nothing but reciprocity, right? It's the fact that you recognize that the customer that you're interacting with is not a opportunity for a one-shot encounter, but rather it's a repeat encounter. And if you treat me nice today, I'll treat you nice tomorrow. And hence my joke with you, my running joke about I might be coming to you for reciprocity in the future.
No, I love it. I think it's great. I mean, I would just add to it that, like, and you've done work on this yourself, and Robert Cialdini, who's from the University of Arizona, has written a couple of books on persuasion. But one thing he says in those books, which I think is applicable to everybody, is that the concept of reciprocity is available to us across cultures and across the many continents. There are 6 continents where human beings live. You could say Antarctica, but it's not really. There's more penguins down there than humans. But on the 6 continents that human beings live on, reciprocity is across languages and across cultures. You do something nice for somebody, they have an impulse, or at least the good ones do, to return the favor. Ben Franklin had the best line ever. I tell all my sales guys this. If you want to make a friend, ask the person for a favor.
Right.
Because what ends up happening is you're engendering the person to want to do something for you. It's an act of kindness on their behalf. They feel good about it. And now all of a sudden you've got the circuit going of what could become a good relationship.
You know, it might interest you to know that in several of my books, I break down consumer acts. And I define consumption very broadly. It's not just consuming Coca-Cola and Starbucks, but we consume friendships. We consume religious narratives. We consume products of popular culture. And I use 4 Darwinian modules. Without getting into too many details, one is the survival module. Second is the mating module. Third is kin selection, how we treat our kin, those who are biologically related to us. And fourth is the reciprocity module, reciprocal altruism. And so I demonstrate that there are many consumer phenomena that are manifestations of this innate and, as you said, universal drive for reciprocity. So, for example, if you and I become friends, I will remember your birthday and invite you out to dinner on your birthday with hopefully the expectation that you'll do the same for me. Now, in reality, from a strict economic perspective, we could just forego this whole ritual because we're going to end up at the same expected utility point. But the reason why we do it is because that reciprocal exchange is what oils and forges our friendship forward, correct?
So I agree with everything that you just said. And I would just add a couple of lines to that is that at the end of the day, after hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary history and billions of years on the planet, we are a social organism. We do our best when we're helping others. We do our best when we're living our lives with purpose. We do our worst when we're taking and not returning something in the process of taking. And so this is one of the weird things about our lives. I have found when people say to me, well, what's the secret to happiness or what's the definition of success? It is teaming up with your friends, celebrating their successes, which is a reduction of your personal envy, and going out of your way to help other human beings. I find, and if you think about these 12-step programs, Doc, what is one of the first things you have to do in a 12-step program to heal yourself is to create a support network around you, go out and sponsor somebody, sit in a group where you can share your stories and try to help each other. And so this is central to our development as human beings, and it is the number one thing that makes for a fantastic business.
Beautiful. Now, another theme that you touch upon in your book is this idea of trust. And so here I wanted to, again, bring some work. This is not my work, but it's within the general area that I work in. There's a gentleman by the name of Paul Zak. He's known as, I think, Dr. Molecule, or I can't remember what his colloquial name is. But he works at the intersection of economics and hormones. And you'll see in a second how it relates to trust. And so he studies oxytocin, which colloquially is referred to as the cuddling hormone, right? So when women are breastfeeding, they release oxytocin. After you've had sex, there's a release of oxytocin. But also, when people get together who are not related and have an intimate moment, a friendly moment, you know, I touch you on the back, we build trust, there's a release of oxytocin. And so he showed through some very clever experiments that oxytocin serves as a wonderful mediator, if you'd like, of the relationship between trust and then effective economic exchanges. What do you think of this theory?
Yeah, I buy into it. I think that, again, business, our friendships, our social relationships, romantic or otherwise, are really derived from our behavior and the mechanisms inside of our brain. And what do we want? We want approval from other people. We want to be accepted. We want to be loved. And we also want to love, and we want to help other people. So yes, I mean, at its base level, you have these hormonal transactions. But here's something I, again, would add. You and I are living inside of 100,000-year-old piece of machinery. It has not had a software upgrade in 100,000 years. So your iPhone went from iPhone 1 to iPhone 7 in a very short period of time, yet you're living still with the mechanisms and the atavism of a Stone Age person. And so what we have to do is we have to step out of that and become more sublime and more human by controlling whatever those negative impulses are. As an example, if you had a better cave than me, I could go over to you, hit you in the head with a rock, and take your cave. Today, there's enough abundance in the society where we shouldn't be doing that to each other. We have to learn to embrace each other. And so this is a transcendental thing that we have to do in order to make ourselves happy and happier.
Wow. Spirituality meets Wall Street. I like it.
I think it's super important, Doc.
I hear you. Continuing with hormones, I just wanted to mention a few other studies. These are not my own studies, although I've worked at the intersection of hormones and consumer behavior. Two studies I'd like to point to. One is a study on entrepreneurship and testosterone, since, of course, your latest book deals with entrepreneurship. So these gentlemen, I think they were at the University of Western Ontario in Canada, looked at male MBA students, measured their testosterone, and then administered to them a, I can't remember the exact scale, but like an entrepreneurship proclivity scale or something to that effect. And they found, perhaps not surprisingly, is that men who scored higher on testosterone also had a corresponding higher score on entrepreneurship. And I think that the mechanism here, or the storyline, is that entrepreneurship involves risk-taking. And since testosterone is, if you like, the hormonal signature that is related to risk-taking, this is why you get this link. What do you think of that?
Again, I would buy into that as well, because at the end of the day, the mechanisms of testosterone, which creates muscularity and creates that forceful hunter-like nature in human beings, I think is very applicable to entrepreneurs. You know, and the weird thing is, you don't have to look like you're bowled up with testosterone to have testosterone. So we have the Revenge of the Nerds in Silicon Valley, and these are the richest people on the planet. And my guess is that even though they don't look like they have this tremendous amount of testosterone, if you blood tested them, my guess is they probably have a tremendous amount of it. And so that's the great irony. Right. You know?
Now let's take hormones to your world of investments. There was a study done, I think, in 2008 or 2009, where they looked at two hormones of male traders, I think on the London floor. Testosterone was one, and there was the typical link that we've just spoken about. Here's yes. another one that you might find interesting. They tracked their cortisol levels.
Yeah.
Cortisol being the stress hormone response mechanism. And they found that it went along. It moved with the volatility of the market. So as the volatility of the market went up and down, the cortisol levels of the traders went up and down, which is a beautiful study. Now, to somebody who is steeped in evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, it seems like a no-brainer that, of course, anything that we do in life is ultimately linked to our biology. Yet, you know, you do an MBA and you study finance, you will never hear of this study. Why do you think there is such a reticence across business to ultimately recognize that everything that we do as employers, employees, consumers is linked to our biology? Where is there that disconnect? Where is it coming from?
You know, I haven't really thought of it. I'm going to answer on the fly because sure. I haven't really thought of it, but I think it's an interesting theory that you're bringing up. My guess is that we have a tough time with the notion that we're basically animals. And so we look at the animal world and we separate ourselves from the animal world and we say, well, you know, that's them and this is us. And so I recommend to everybody to go on safari or to watch a documentary of a safari, because when I went on safari a few years ago in Kenya, it was about 260 miles north of Nairobi, and spent 6 days in a camp, you know, seeing the big five and watching migrations and the way the animals interacted with each other and how they cared for their young or how they mated and how they responded and how they observed danger or avoided danger. And, you know, we went out on night safari, and all of a sudden you come back from that experience and you're like, wait a minute, okay, we really are just highly developed cognitive thinking animals, okay? And so this is the one reason why I try to bring the spirituality into it, because at the end of the day, I do believe it's your mindset, doctor, that sets you apart from the animal world. It's a way to think. It's a habit. It's a force in your personality that can turn into good character, which leads to your grace, which leads to your kindness, which also leads to your productivity and your ability to innovate and create. But if you're making the case that we're one part estrogen, one part testosterone, one part oxytocin, cortisol, all of these other things are mixed into the mix, there's no question about it. In fact, there was a study, and I think somebody got accused of feeding their male traders estrogen years ago. I don't know if you remember that whole thing, to reduce their
risk elements. Risk taking, right.
Yeah, they were trying to reduce their elements of risk taking, so they were feeding them estrogen. So when they sat on the trading floor, they got more cautious, okay? And so maybe the estrogen side of things is for nesting and for implantation, and maybe the testosterone side of things is for hunting. You know, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be treated equally. I'm not suggesting that. Of course, women and men should have equal rights, equal opportunity, equal pay, all those other things. But I do think you and I would both agree that biologically there are different elements going on. Just the fact that, you know, one sex menstruates and the other one doesn't is one example of that. So doesn't mean that it shouldn't be treated equal. I'm not suggesting that. It's just that biologically there are differences, and we have to look at and study those differences.
You know, so two points. A great response on the fly. Number one, your intuition that people have a reticence to accept that we are ultimately animals is spot on, because that's something that I've documented in my own career as an academic. And as a matter of fact, there's a term for it. This is not my term. It's called the human reticence effect, which basically goes as follows. It's great to use evolutionary theory to explain the behavior of the mosquito and the zebra and the lion, but don't you dare apply it to human beings. What makes us humans is that we transcend our biology. Well, of course, that's laughably wrong. Regarding your second point about sex differences, this is something that I've been involved in fighting in academia for 2 decades, because in the social sciences, sort of the accepted narrative has been that all sex differences are social constructions, which again, an average 2-year-old knows that to be false. And as you said, equity feminism makes sense, right? We should all be equal under the law. There should be no discrimination based on whether I menstruate. But to argue that to protect that ultimate objective, we should assume that men and women are indistinguishable from one another is crazy.
Yeah. Well, listen, I agree with that. And I think we run a danger in our society of becoming too politically correct. And someone will have to answer this for me. Maybe it's you or maybe some great philosopher out there. How the political correctness, if you don't speak politically correctly or you have a difference of opinion, how that's shamed in the society. Because if we're talking about concepts of individual liberty, then part of our liberty is our ability to express ourselves and our self-expression. And so I just find this mock outrage that goes on now in our society be horrendous.
It's my next book, good sir. Stay tuned.
Yeah, I just find it horrendous, because at the end of the day, the left and the political correct people want us all to think and feel and act the same. And if we don't share their same values or share their same sandbox, then therefore there's something wrong with us, and they need to control our speech and control our mannerisms and our behavior. And that is so counter to the Western idealism of liberal thinking and the individuality of spirit and your ability to freely express yourself and also express your life in whatever context that you want to make it, as long as it's not harming others.
I hear you. Now, final point on sex differences, linking it to the Wall Street ecosystem. Do you think that to the extent that there are huge sex differences in many of these subfields of investment, is it largely driven by systemic patriarchal sexism? Or do you think that men and women at this point are willfully assorting themselves into occupational trajectories that they prefer?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. I don't know the exact blend of what that combination is from a pie chart, but I do think that things do happen for a reason. And the native origination of things, the way that they happened and transpired in world history, you know, it probably could be related to testosterone. It could be related to the fact that men had more of a physical force and they were able to use that to create this patriarchal system. Today, as the physical forces become less important and it's the cognitive forces that have become more important in our society today, it's leveling the playing field for women and it's making it easier for them to assert themselves. I will say this, it's a very interesting time in the world and in the marketplace of ideas because, and again, I'm a Donald Trump supporter. We can talk about that. Sure. I do still think he's going to win. I'll explain why. But if Secretary Clinton were to win, you'd have a situation where the Western leadership is predominantly women at a time where Western adversaries are predominantly autocratic men. Be an interesting conflict there in terms of the psychological relationships, the biological relationships, and others. It'll be an interesting time in history to observe.
So since we've touched now on Trump, let's get into it. I recently appeared on – do you know who Sam Harris is?
Yes. He's written a couple of big books, predominantly an atheist. He's open letters and so forth.
Right. So I appear on this podcast and on most things we tend to.
I don't get any credit for that, Doc. That was pretty good.
That was very, very impressive. I like your style, sir. I appeared on this podcast and, you know, we agree on most things. But one area that we disagreed on is that I was trying to offer him another perspective on Trump. And again, I'll start here by saying that I'm Canadian, so I don't have a dog in the fight, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I'm looking at it truly as a dispassionate observer, notwithstanding the fact that obviously U.S. politics have an ultimate effect on Canada, of course. And so I was arguing that, you know, a person could be very reasonable and very rational and not a hick who's toothless from Arkansas, who denies evolution and still love Donald Trump. I don't know if I've moved them at all. But anyways, I certainly encourage you to check it out. But let's get into
I'll definitely look at it. It'll give me some fodder for things that I'm expressing. But go ahead.
So you tell me. So why is it that you're supporting Trump? Why do you think that he still looks like he's going to win?
Yeah.
And what is it that you don't like about Clinton?
Well, okay. So first of all, this is all about policy for me. So if you follow me on Twitter or you've heard me on television, I never attack the secretary related to her personality or related to the snafus that she's had or possible transgressions or allegations. I never do that. I just focus on the actual policies and what they mean for the society and the American people, the Canadian people, and the rest of the world. As it relates to Mr. Trump, I think it's an interesting phenomenon that's happening because he is only a politician for 17 months of his life. And so if you think of what he's done from a historical context, it's absolutely staggering. And the reason he's been successful in doing that is that there is a real systemic problem in America right now as it relates to the political elites that are running Washington and America. And so for me, this is an indictment of both parties. It's a Liz pendants against Republicans and Democrats that are in the swamp of Washington, that are currying favor for themselves and creating a power base for themselves. At the same time is that they're impairing the average person. And so, you know, you've heard all of these cliches before, so I won't go into too many of them. But when the government no longer fears the people and the people fear the government, that's the beginning of tyranny. And so we have to disrupt that. If you understand the base elements of our Constitution and the philosophical ideology of the framers, both the left and right framers of our Constitution, they all agreed on one thing, and that was the core individual liberty and individual expression. And so unfortunately, what the left wants to do is they want to floor that and create a safety net, which I totally agree with, but they want to cap it as well, and they want to create a ceiling for people. And I think that that is a big, big disaster, because there's where all of your innovation and all of your movement towards modernity lives, above that ceiling. And so for me, I can argue point for point, you want to pick a topic: immigration, trade, taxation, regulation, things that affect people's real life, day-to-day, healthcare. I can look through all those topics and I can say, listen, Mr. Trump has the best answer for all of those different things. Now, someone will come back to me and say, well, he's unsuitable for the presidency. My response is, okay, if you want to go in that direction, then it's like a quadratic equation that we learned about in high school. The secretary's unsuitability cancels out his unsuitability. And so let's focus just on the ideas. And I just think he has better ideas. And by the way, since I know him personally, sit on his economic advisory board, work as one of his national co-finance chairs, and have traveled all over the country on his plane with him, and spent a good part of my week with him, at least the last couple of weeks, because we're getting close to the end here. I can tell you that the guy is a brilliant guy, super hardworking, has a great understanding of the issues, is a great questioner, great synthesizer of ideas. I would say that his weakness, and I would say this right to him right now, if he was sitting here with us, I would say that his weakness is that he's a bit of an entertainer. You know, Elton John once said about Trump that he is the best live entertainer, Doc, that doesn't sing or play a musical instrument. And so he gets up there and he's subjected to these rhetorical flourishes that really only a New Yorker, he was born in Queens, I was born on Long Island, only a New Yorker can really identify with, because he'll fly off the handle. He'll say stuff, and he does it on purpose sometimes because he likes to strike a match into the mainstream media and throw a Molotov cocktail. So what are those Molotov cocktails? I'm not going to accept the results of the election. He sends them on these tangents. I'm not going to recognize or pretend that I know who David Duke is, as an example. And these are all things that he's doing, which are rhetorical devices to send these people into orbit. You know, I was reading some ridiculous person saying, well, he couldn't be trusted with the nuclear codes, that he would bring down the civilization by pressing the nuclear button. Okay. I mean, it's just absurd. Okay. He's got young children and he's got even younger grandchildren. He loves all of them. He's got very, very good judgment, and he's not a person that would do that. Moreover, he's also the type of guy that can surround himself with super talented people. So I'm probably over talking the answer to the question, but I just want to say two last things. We have a tendency in our society, maybe they do it in Canada, to demonize these people. And I'm saying for the health of the polity and for the health of the general public, we have to figure out a way to stop doing that, because whoever wins, he's going to have a very high negative approval rating going into the leadership process next year. And that's not going to be good for the American people.
So great defense of Trump. Let me, as an unpaid consultant for the Trump campaign, let me give you some unsolicited advice that you might
Please. Share
with him.
I'm all ears.
So I think one of the, and I see this because I see my academic colleagues, all of whom are in complete unison that he's a simpleton, you know, guy who's going to set the world ablaze, right? Which obviously is a gross, caricature of what he would do. And I'm amazed that all of these otherwise sophisticated intellectual types could all be in agreement, right? Not one of them says anything out of step, right? So I'm with you, and I've certainly gone on record saying that between Trump and Clinton, I would prefer.
But not interrupt you, but they have to do that because they have to be in that salon together, and they have to pat each other on the back sociologically. They're doing that in Hollywood. I mean, just to tell your viewers a quick story, there's a gentleman, I don't even want to bring up his name because I don't want to give him any publicity, but the gentleman in Hollywood, he wrote a script for a mini series or whatever it is, and he wanted my time, wanted my energy, wanted to come to my conference, the SALT conference, and all this other stuff. And then he promised to do a few things for me. Whether he did or he didn't really matter that much to me. I said, okay, no problem, I'll do this stuff for you. And then he's like, oh, with this mock outrage and horror, Right. You're a Trump supporter. And so as a result of which our friendship is over. And it's like, okay, who are you scoring points with that sort of nonsense? And so not to interrupt, but my point is that if people are really going to ignore their friends or lose friendships over an election, it says more about them
Right. Than
it does about a person like me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. So let me now say what I think is a potential problem with Trump. Here's a study that some of my students had done in one of my courses many years ago. Very simple study, but that demonstrates something very powerful, and then I'll link it to Trump. So you take a package and you either create a product and you create a fancy package or a cheap package, and you put the exact same product, let's say a pair of basketball socks,
sure,
in each, right? Now it's the same pair of basketball socks. 50 people try the pair in the fancy package, 50 people try the pair in the non-fancy package, and you ask them a whole bunch of quality measures. You know, how likely is it to rip? How likely is it to absorb sweat and so on? And not surprisingly, contrary to classical economic theory, people judge the quality of the product that is in the fancy package as being superior to the less, right? Because
does that surprise you?
No. But we're just gonna analogize now to Trump. So packaging matters, exactly as you said, because in all sorts of walks of life, how we dress affects whether we appear credible or not, hence another form of packaging. So I think in the case of Trump, his packaging, because of some of his vernacular, because of some of his Twitter wars, because of some of the things that he says that if he were a bit more, quote, presidential in his restraint, would work in his favor. Yes. He would be part of the fancy package, and it would take a lot of the fodder that is thrown in terms of the animus towards him away. So if I were advising Trump, I would say, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, when you're going to go on Twitter to talk about how fat Rosie O'Donnell is, maybe don't, because that puts you in the cheap, idiotic package. You understand what I'm saying? So if we agree that packaging is a ubiquitous mechanism found across many domains, then let's apply it to Trump.
Well, okay. So, I mean, listen, I agree with everything you just said. And I also very focused on packaging, not to bring the book up again, but just take a look. You know, we really did try to focus on the packaging. Right. Okay. Orange happens to be in favor, and the logo with the little hole and everything. I mean, there was a lot of time put into the packaging. Right. And so with Trump, the problem with what you're saying for him, and I'm going to speak on his behalf, is that he views his ascent in the last 17 months as a political figure related to his unpackaged, unvarnished nature.
Can I interrupt you right there?
And by the way, I would then say to him, yes, but you now have to pivot like every good entrepreneur and transition to a better package. But go ahead, I'm sorry. I'll tell you what his response is to that as well.
Most traits follow an inverted U-shape. So take a word that you use in your book, perfectionism, right? Up to a certain point, perfectionism is good because it compels me to care about my work, to worry about details. If perfectionism passes that inverted U-shape, that inflection point, and then it becomes stunting, right? Then it becomes pathological perfectionism. Therefore, I now spend 18 hours checking my email to make sure that there isn't a comma out of place. It becomes too much. So now let's apply it to what you just said to Trump. Up to a certain point, his fly off the cuff, his irreverence, his non-interest in political correctness is good, but then you cross the inflection point. Don't cross it.
You have me, and you had me at hello with the whole idea.
My very good looks. That's what I had.
It was actually the way you trim your beard. That's what's really got me the most excited.
That's my wife. But go ahead.
But here's what I would say to you. Okay, he's 70. He's a young 70. He's got a tremendous amount of energy. And you are not going to change him. There's also something that I learned with Governor Romney. Okay, you can't put into somebody what God left out. It's just the way it works in these things, okay? And so same way I could say to you, if I was Secretary Clinton's advisor, I'd say, wow, you know, you got to be more energetic and less controlled. Okay, as an example, I was at the Alfred E. Smith dinner last week. I don't know if you follow politics that well, but that's a dinner.
I watched it, but I didn't get an invitation. That's the problem.
Okay, so that's an opportunity for these people to roast each other politely. It's not an opportunity for each other to steamroll each other in front of the cardinal. Okay, and so we can debate about what happened or what didn't happen there, but you know, she had an opportunity to really hurt Mr. Trump, and she couldn't because she couldn't get herself off script. Okay. Somebody like Barack Obama or somebody like Bill Clinton, they would have been able to have done that. Somebody like her, incapable of doing that. Okay. And again, you know, you can't put into somebody what God left out. Here's what I would say about both these candidates. Look at the policies. You tell me what you think is going to be better for our society, and then you should vote as such. If you want more government control in your life, if you want more caps on your ability and your children's ability to go ahead, if you want more regulation, which, by the way, more regulation, fantastic for SkyBridge. Let me tell you why. I've got the 9 attorneys. If I have to hire 5 more attorneys, no problem. But if I wanted to start SkyBridge today in 2016, my first 9 employees would be those attorneys. I wouldn't be able to compete. And so what the regulators are doing, doctrine of unintended consequence, is they're eliminating competition from the marketplace with all of this burdensome regulation. And so what happens in a left-leaning society is that the rich become even more powerful. The big corporations and corporocrats become even more powerful. And the opportunity to disrupt these people and the opportunity to create the aspirational working class that we all would like to have, which I am a product of, that goes by the wayside. So if that's the direction you want to go in, at least let's really clinically understand that that's the direction that we're going in. If that's what you want to do, listen, I live in a democracy. I'm an adaptive person. I'll work my way around it.
I
worry about the people, doctor, sure, that are in your class, that are your students, that grew up with lunch pail workers like my dad was. I worry about the people whose parents never went to college. Neither one of my parents did. Who have aspirations to create jobs and innovation and excitement in their lives. I worry about them because what the left is doing to those people is they're accidentally suppressing them in a way that I think is very tragic.
I hear you. I think if I were to look at all the differences in terms of their the various issues in terms of their policies, the one that at least I find most important, and you tell me if you agree or whether you think another one is more important, is their positions on sort of the open door immigration policies, their willingness to admit that there is such a thing as Islamic threat or not, or never utter the words. That for me is the one that differentiates the two, because I, as I explained on Sam Harris's podcast, in terms of the immediate impact of either candidates, I mean, yes, of course, there will be some economic impact, but I take a long view of history. And if you continue to allow these sort of open door immigration policies, and I'm not so much talking about our neighbors and friends from the South, I'm talking about folks who come who don't share any of our values that define the West and modernity and liberalism. In the generation of your children or your grandchildren and mine, this is when we will start seeing the problems. And I come from a region of the world where I know of what I speak, right? So from that perspective, to me, then on that issue, Trump has it and Clinton doesn't. Do you agree that that might be the number one issue, or do you place that lower on sort of the ranking?
Well, listen, let me tell you, the American people view it as the number one issue. So it doesn't really matter what I think. I think that is definitely there. And then the philosophy of what I call the individuality of liberalism is something that the Trump people and predominantly Republicans aspire to more. But I want to address those two things. Number one, Milton Friedman said that you can't have a welfare state and an open border. So if the left wants a welfare state, and by the way, I do agree that we need a safety net to protect the people that are the weakest among our society, because that's good for all of us. It's good comity. You don't want to live, and I don't want to live in a barbed-wired compound with a McMansion and security. I definitely don't want that. I want my neighbors to be doing very, very well. So we have to help the people at the base of the society. There's no question about that. But if you're going to do that, then you have to control the border, because if you don't do that, if you have a welfare state and no border control, then you're going to lose the country, because what happens is people that need the welfare and the entitlements, they'll show up in your country and they'll deplete your treasury. And that's just common sense. Second thing that you're talking about, you're looking at a person that's traveled to Kabul. I've been with the American troops in Afghanistan. I've been with the American troops in Iraq. I understand the issues there because I've done on the ground field research as not only a concerned citizen, but somebody that wants to support our troops. And what I would tell you is that there is a real systemic threat. There is an ideological and philosophical struggle that's going on in the world right now. There's a group of people that want us to be in the 11th century, and there's another group of people that want us to be in the 22nd century. I've chosen to be in the 22nd century. So if you're arriving in the country and want to pull the country back to the 11th century, we gotta figure out a way to stop that. And so that may sound Islamophobic, that may sound racist, but it really isn't. It's just about what is good for the most amount of citizens. At the end of the day, in our social contract, that's the way we have to think, if we're going to have any bent towards public service.
Well, there's, you know, it always irks me so much when people levy all these Islamophobia and racism and bigotry things, and I satirize them. Because, I mean, let's analogize. I mean, you have a right to decide who you're going to be friends with, who you're going to invite to your party, who's going to be close to your children. And you make those decisions every day based on certain traits of the prospective people that you may or may not invite to your party. So by what logic are you not allowed to make the exact same calculation when it comes to deciding who you let into the country or not? If you do not share our values, if you don't agree that all people are equal,
we agree.
That, you know, but why is it that for you and me it's so obvious that this is a no-brainer, but yet so many people on the left, the minute that you start engaging in this discourse, you must be Dr. Mengele of the Nazi Party.
Because you and I are products of our environment. We're products of our historical understanding of what's going on. We're also your products of your family of origin. I'm product of my family of origin. And so we're looking at it very realistically. But a lot of the times what I find on the left is there's this false idealism. The notion that we can have an open border or an open hemisphere, that didn't work for our founders. It didn't work for Great Britain. It didn't work for France. Any of these countries, okay, that have subscribed themselves to open borders have been demolished. Okay, so you have to look at it clinically, and you have to assess it in terms of what is in the best interest of the country and the best interest of the citizens of that country. Now, I don't think that we need to reject the rest of the world or become an isolationist. And boy, I wish the rest of the world could hear Mr. Trump talk about this as we're flying around. He's not an isolationist. He's very far from it. He's, in fact, perhaps could be the last hope for globalism, because at the end of the day, he wants free trade. He just wants the trade to be fairer to the United States. He wants, and he has said this repeatedly, he wants waves and waves of immigrants to come into the United States. He would just like them to come in legally. I don't see what could be that big of a deal. You have a Congress that has voted on immigration rules. You've had two different presidents, Democrats and Republicans, sign those immigration laws. He just wants to enforce those laws that were already approved and signed by two prior presidents. Why do you think the Border Patrol agents are endorsing Mr. Trump? There's 16,500 of them. They understand the problem. They understand the drug problem. They understand the immigration problem. They understand the burden on the welfare state that this is bringing to the United States. This is not inhumane. This is not unfair. This is the practical reality of the society that we're living in today. And so I don't know. I'm sure someone on the left listening to this conversation, you're Dr. Mengele and I'm Joseph Goebbels. I guess how we're going to be treated. Because it's an ad hominem attack. When you make sense to somebody and you're saying something that's very logical and reasoned, but also compassionate, you know, because I have a great love of people, as I know you do. I love human beings. I love people. And Churchill once said about human beings, those that are the best among us choose not to judge human beings' frailty with such harshness. Okay. And so I'm all for that. But as a person that loves my country and loves the origin of the country and the framing of the country, let's stick to that. That's gotten us to be the most powerful, most successful country in history, alongside of your great country. Let's continue that path.
Thank you.
What's wrong with that?
I hear you. Now, why do you think, in light of all of the polls coming in, I don't know if it was on air or off air, you had mentioned that you feel very confident that Mr. Trump will win. Yep. Can you explain to us that optimism in light of the polls?
Well, listen, the WikiLeaks has exposed that they've worked very hard with the mainstream media, the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, to oversample Democrats in these polls. Okay, they've definitely done that. And so a lot of these poll numbers, he's down 12 and all this sort of nonsense, that's as a result of oversampling of Democrats in the polls. Now, I'm not saying he's not down. I'm a big believer in the polls. Sean Hannity and I were talking about this last week, that we both look at the polls and have to accept prima facie that the average of those polls are probably correct, because, you know, some polls are oversampling or undersampling. But a couple of polls that have been very accurate over the last three or four presidential cycles are the Investment Business Daily TPP poll. And in that poll, he's up 2 nationally. In that poll, he's inside the margin of error as it relates to a lot of these battleground states. So it's impossible to know. But as a sportsman and as a competitive athlete my entire life, we're in the fourth quarter. You tell me how many minutes are left. You want to walk off the field right now? It seems like the other side is gloating like they've already won the game. Now, maybe they have. And if they have, I'll tell you what I will do. I will wish her well because I'm a patriot first and I'm a partisan second, and I would like her to be successful. If she loses, I would hope they would do the same for our group of people as we go down to Washington and try to make things better for the American people.
Have you seen the letter? Excuse me for interrupting. Have you seen the letter that was recently posted that came from the first President Bush to Bill Clinton, sort of congratulating him and wishing him well? Yep. Wasn't that incredibly gracious?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was in the drawer in the desk, the Resolute desk. And each president, Reagan wrote one to Bush, and George W. Bush wrote one for Obama. I can only imagine the letter Obama's going to write to Trump when he's president, but we'll have to see what that one is. But listen, and I do appreciate this, and I do have a sense for history. I can't say that I have the empathy because I've never sat in the Oval Office as the American president, but I do have an appreciation for the fact that that's an incredibly hard job. And I don't like criticizing President Obama personally or criticizing Secretary Clinton personally. I just want to litigate the policies. I think that George W. Bush, by the way, is a classy guy. Whatever you think of his presidency or his policies, the fact that he said, hey, I'm not going to be part of the grandstand criticizing the current president because I know how hard the job is, I admire him for that. I wonder if President Obama will do that when Mr. Trump is trying to organize the new government. I wonder if he'll be able to do that. It'll be interesting to see.
I'm smelling a cabinet position for you.
No. You see, that's another thing you'll get from my book, Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole. Look at the.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me this morning, a Wall Street Journal journalist said, why would I read that book? That is a book about self-promotion from a self-promoter. I said, well, that's exactly why you would read the book.
Okay, it's funny you say this because sometimes I share things on my social media pages, you know, check out my latest clip. And someone will say, oh, you're such a self-promoter. And I say, yeah, it's called marketing. I'm a professor of marketing. No kidding. What do you use social media for?
Tell your students that it's okay. You know, and don't be self-conscious. Usually when someone's telling you that there's two things I got to leave you with. Unfortunately, I have to go to another meeting.
Worries.
I'll leave you with two quick things. Number one, tell your students it's okay to self-promote. And number two, they better hope and pray in life that they're getting criticized, either on Twitter or other places, because they don't boo nobody's, Doc. Okay, and at the end of the day, you got to be breaking some eggs to make omelets, and so you got to hope that people are bashing you a little, because if they're not, then, you know, it's not working for you. In fact, the bashing converted in your mind as a huge compliment, and you'll see it'll get you a lot farther.
Thank you for the advice. Great chatting with you. Stay on the line for a second. Talk to you soon. Stay on the line.
Okay, you got it. And we're going to send you an invite to this.